Today, the narrow path is beset with uncertainty. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. On Friday, RBA Governor Michelle Bullock and her New Look team were questioned by the House Economics Committee in Canberra, actually for most of the morning.
Michelle Bullock, Governor, Reserve Bank of Australia.
Andrew Hauser, Deputy Governor.
Sarah Hunter, Assistant Governor, Economic.
Christopher Kent, Assistant Governor, Financial Markets.
Brad Jones, Assistant Governor, Financial System.
And I watched it all, so you don't have to. There was actually very little new news at one level, because the bank had recently released its statement of monetary policy and its rate decision. Worth recalling that the Reserve Bank left the key rate at a 12-year high of 4.35%, and it maintained its hawkish rhetoric. Money markets and economists still reckon the RBA's next move will be a cut, though they're split on the timing, with traders betting December will be the beginning of the easing cycle, while the consensus of economists is it will only start sometime in 2025. While the consensus among economists is still that the RBA will hold rates at 4.35% this year, some believe a hike cannot be ruled out, especially if a second quarter inflation report on July the 31st surprises on the upside. Australian households will need to grapple with another interest rate hike, said Josh Williamson, economist at Citigroup in Sydney. This could take the wind out of the consumer in the second half. The RBA has kept its policy rate steady since last November and remains in data-dependent mode, with its forecast showing inflation will only fall back within the 2-3% target next year. Bullock has expressed a willingness to be patient as she seeks to slow inflation without choking off economic growth.
The board's trying to bring inflation back to target in a reasonable time frame, while preserving as many of the gains in the labour market that we've seen in the past few years. This is the so-called narrow path. So how are we doing? Well, since our previous appearance before this committee, there has been further progress on inflation, but it has been slow. Inflation peaked at 7.8% in the December quarter of 2022. It came down to 4.1% at the end of 2023, but since then it's only declined a further 0.3 percentage points to 3.8% in the June quarter of 2024. Underlying inflation, which abstracts from volatile components of the index, is also still elevated at 3.9% in June 2024, and this remains too high. Our current forecasts have underlying inflation by the end of this year still sitting around 3.5%. Now, what's driving this persistent inflation? A lot of it reflects inflation in services. Most of the disinflation we've seen since the peak in December 2022 has been driven by a decline in goods price inflation. Through 2022, there was very high inflation in goods prices, reflecting supply chain issues at a time of strong aggregate demand. Prices of groceries, consumer durables, and new dwelling construction costs all surged. Inflation in many of these goods has since eased substantially, except for new dwelling costs, which are still increasing by around about 5% on an annual basis. Inflation in services prices, on the other hand, has remained high, running at around 5%. There's been broad-based inflation in market services, reflecting continued demand and the ability for some businesses to pass through costs. Other contributors to high inflation have been rents and insurance, reflecting conditions specific to those industries. All of this has meant that while goods price inflation has declined substantially, it hasn't been enough to offset continued high services price inflation. This situation is not unique to Australia. Most advanced economies have experienced a similar pattern of inflation, a spike in inflation owing to goods and energy prices, followed by a sharp disinflation in goods prices, but continued high services price inflation. As a result, other central banks are remaining cautious about the future path of interest rates. Some have reduced their policy rates a little, but they have been emphasising that the job is still not done and policy remains restrictive. Likewise here in Australia. We didn't increase interest rates as much as some other central banks, and we have received some criticism for that. Indeed, some commentators continue to call for further tightening in monetary policy. But as I noted earlier, we've been trying to balance bringing inflation back down over a reasonable timeframe without inflicting unnecessary damage on the labour market. And the board's judgment to date has been that policy is currently sufficiently restrictive to do that.
It's clear from Governor Bullock's opening statement that Australia's central bank remains some way off easing monetary policy because inflation is proving persistent and will only return back to target next year. The board remains vigilant to upside risks to inflation, Bullock said in her opening statement to the parliamentary panel in Canberra on Friday. It's premature to be thinking about rate cuts. Supporting the RBA's caution, data this week showed Australia's labour market continued to add jobs at a solid pace, while wages growth remains elevated, see my earlier show, when things don't end up at the RBA. And separate figures pointed to a small rebound in consumer sentiment and business confidence is also holding up. Circumstances may change, of course, and the outlook is uncertain, Bullock told lawmakers, but based on what the board knows at present, it does not expect that it will be in a position to cut rates in the near term. That assessment is a key reason why the RBA is seen trailing major global counterparts when it comes to easing and setting Australia up as a potential outlier. UBS said that the resilience of the labour market, together with Friday's testimony, supports our view that interest rates will remain higher for longer, at least relative to global trends, which are increasingly dovish. And she also highlighted some of the risks to the Australian growth and inflation story, including the future trajectory of household consumption, issues with residential construction, and broader geopolitical questions such as risks to energy supply from the Middle East conflicts and the future trajectory of China's economy.
As I noted earlier, the central forecasts are for inflation to return to the target range late in 2025. It's forecast to approach the midpoint of the target band in 2026. This is a slightly slower return to target than we were forecasting in May. It reflects a judgment that the gap between aggregate demand and supply in the economy is larger than we previously thought. So that is, even though growth in the economy has been weak, the level of demand for goods and services is still higher than the ability of the economy to sustainably produce those goods and services. Now, these are our central forecasts, and there is substantial uncertainty around them, and more so the further you go out in the forecast period. So, recognising this, we highlighted three key risks in our statement on monetary policy. First, that there'd be more excess demand in the economy at present than we've currently assessed. Secondly, that consumption growth in the future could be stronger or weaker than expected. And third, the labour market could deteriorate by more than expected. And the statement provided some scenarios to demonstrate how different paths for the economy might affect the outcomes for inflation and employment.
I was interested in your thoughts on some of the broader contextual trends affecting Australia. What are some of the key risks to the global outlook in your modelling and your analysis?
Sure. So I highlighted earlier that inflation, although it's coming down overseas, it is remaining persistent. And although some other countries have started to lower their interest rates in response to that, they are cautious. And they're cautious because services inflation is remaining relatively elevated. So some of the risks around that are that central banks find that things turn down more quickly than they're expecting, and that was sort of part of the reason for the volatility in financial markets a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. when there was an employment number for the United States that people thought was indicating that the labour market was deteriorating quite a lot, and they reacted quite heavily to it. And there was a lot more to it than that, and we can talk about that separately if you like, but that was sort of the proximate cause. So there is a risk that things turn down more quickly, and in that case, central banks may have to lower interest rates quite quickly. That's one risk. A risk that's very pertinent for us is China. The Chinese economy is still performing okay. It's meeting their target of around about 5% growth, but they still have a very big drag from the problems in their real estate sector there.
Mm-hmm.
And China is really important for us because of our trade relationship with China. It's our biggest trading partner. And it's very important in particular for the prices of the commodities that we export, in particular iron ore. So that is something that we're watching quite closely, because that can, developments in China can have quite a big impact on the way our trade develops, and that therefore on our growth. So I'd say they're two of the key risks. There are, of course, a variety of risks associated with geopolitical tensions, which we don't know how it's going to turn out. I think the risks there are really going to, if they eventuate, they're going to eventuate in supply issues. Mm-hmm. So we already saw that in the big energy shocks a couple of years ago. Energy is critical there. But any supply shocks which influence inflation, again, is going to make it difficult for central banks, because typically we would like to look through supply shocks. But if they're consistent and persistent, it makes it very difficult to just completely ignore them and the potential impact they might have on an ongoing sense in the on inflation expectations and the level of inflation around the world. So they're probably the main things I'd highlight.
Which takes us to an interesting analysis of monetary policy in Australia versus New Zealand, bearing in mind the Reserve Bank there cut rates this week. As I discussed in the recent post, they opened the door to interest rate cuts, with its tighter policy stance curbing demand across the economy and boosting confidence that inflation will return to target. Looking back, the two central banks plotted very different courses through the post-pandemic inflation battle. The RBA moved cautiously on the way up, taking its cash rate to 4.35% in November 2023 from 0.1% in 2022, for a total of 4.25 percentage points of hikes. The New Zealand Bank moved faster, hiked by 5.25%. Monetary policy has gained more traction in New Zealand as a result. One problem for the RBA is that inflation expectations in Australia haven't remained as anchored as they have in New Zealand. Policymakers were closely monitoring longer-term inflation expectations, saying a drift higher would require significantly higher interest rates. In Australia, home prices have been rising since February 2023, with bellwether Sydney at a record high, unlike those across the ditch, where the Reserve Bank of New Zealand's policy tightening has taken the wind out of New Zealand's housing market after falling for most of last year. Home building costs in the country dropped for the first time in at least 12 years in the June quarter, unlike in Australia, where they're still rising. An RBA rate rise could certainly slow demand and signal to the market that interest rates are not yet at peak, or at the very least, are likely to take longer to reduce, said Eliza Owen, head of research at CoreLogic. She estimates another rate hike would push mortgage monthly repayments over $4,000 on current median dwelling values. The RBA describes Australia's labour market as still tight, though some leading indicators, such as job vacancies and applications per job ad, are pointing to a slack market ahead. The unemployment rate in New Zealand, while still low, has risen relatively sharply over the past year, in a sign monetary policy is having more impact there. In fact, New Zealand has suffered a double-dip recession, and the economy likely contracted again in the 3 months through to June, which could mean gross domestic product has declined again in five of the past seven quarters. Excluding the pandemic contraction, Australia has not had a recession since the 1990s, thanks to massive recent migration, of course, which remains higher. But in New Zealand, migration is now easing and fast. Well, it was clear that aggregate demand in Australia continued to exceed the economy's capacity to supply. By contrast, the Reserve Bank in New Zealand said on Wednesday that there is now more evidence of excess productive capacity emerging in New Zealand. And they say that monetary policy needs fiscal support. That's more the case in New Zealand than in Australia. Net government spending in Australia is seen boosting aggregate demand by a chunky 2.2 percentage points of GDP in the year ending June 2025. That's according to Westpac, and is linked to big spending state governments. Fiscal policy in Australia mostly, but not exclusively, at the state government level has not helped, says Stephen Miller, investment strategist at GSFM in Sydney. With excess demand a primary driver of inflation, that government contribution is problematic. In fact, it's worth noting that Governor Michelle Bullock has softened the bank's previous warning that government spending is contributing to inflation, and instead pointed to consumer spending in a messaging shift that will help shore up relations with Treasurer Jim Chalmers.
I had a couple of questions on the relationship between fiscal policy and monetary policy, which has been the subject of some discussion recently. You've made a couple of comments on fiscal policy broadly. I just wanted to, in a sense, start with the overarching picture and just to go back to, I think what's fair to say is your observation that the government having run consecutive surpluses in broad terms puts downward pressure on inflation.
I want to make a few points here, just right up front on this issue. So, yes, I have noted that the government banking, the extra revenue, if you like, that came from very favourable commodity prices resulting in two surpluses has been helpful. But let me make a few points about where we are at the moment. So the government and us are concerned about inflation. The government has said this, the Treasurer has said this, and I have said this. We're all concerned about inflation. But both us and the government are also concerned about maintaining the gains in the labour market. It's part of our mandate, and the government obviously are concerned about that as well. So we're completely aligned on this. We have different tools, though. I have an interest rate. It's a very blunt tool. It impacts different people differently. Mm-hmm. We know this. And we know that it hurts people with mortgages and debts, businesses with debts, more. We know that. But it's the only tool we have. And we try to use it to bring demand down so that it's not pushing up against supply and we don't have inflation. That's what we do. Governments have fiscal policy. And yes, government fiscal policy can influence inflation, but fiscal policy is much more than that. Fiscal policy needs to balance a range of things. Governments, and I say governments, because the state governments are important in this as well, they need to balance a range of things that call on their budget. Health, education, aged care, NDIS, infrastructure, which is really important to the running of the economy. All these things need to be dealt with fiscally. And as I said, I say governments because state governments account for a lot of public demand as well. It's not just a federal government thing. But I want to be clear that public demand is not the main game at the moment. I talked earlier about the sorts of things that we're worried about. The uncertainties around consumption, the uncertainties around residential construction, the uncertainties around trade, these are the things that are going to be critical to the evolution of the economy inflation over the next couple of years. The scenarios we did in the Statement on Monetary Policy, that's what that was about. We're looking, what are the big swing things that are going to impact us over the next year or so? These are the things that are going to have the impact, and these are the things that we're most uncertain about, and we're therefore focusing on very heavily and focusing on the risks around them.
Bullock's clarification comes after the bank's previous blunter assessment on federal and state government spending annoyed the Albanese Labour government. Dr. Chalmers disagreed with the RBA's call that demand was running too hot, and Bill Shorten warned that the bank could cause a recession with higher interest rates. EY economist Cheryl Murphy said Ms. Bullock seemed to be trying to play down the point about government spending, but her reasons for doing so may not be entirely economics after the political fury surrounding the RBA. Dr. Chalmers said in a podcast released on Friday, the Reserve Bank governor and I both say, in our own way, that we've got the same objective here, which is to fight inflation, but we've got different responsibilities. And when it comes to public spending, I don't think anyone seriously suggests that government spending in a budget is the primary determinant of prices in our economy. We're talking here about a net additional spend of about $10 billion in the context of a $2.6 trillion economy. But of course, the Stage 3 tax cuts were already in the RBA's models. So all up, the federal and state support is closer to $40 billion at the last count, which is actually quite a big number. New Zealand's government, on the contrary, is focused on reducing spending as it forecasts a return to budget surpluses in 2028. Australian dollar is its highest level against the Kiwi since 2022 due to the diverging monetary policy outlooks. Now, it's interesting that voters are more likely to believe that the government sector is contributing to persistent inflation. That's according to JWS Research's True Issues survey. Some 34% of those surveyed thought government spending was increasing inflation, compared with only 15% who agreed government spending was reducing inflation. Some 36% of the 1,000 people surveyed said that governments had made no difference. The survey did not delineate between federal and state governments and just asked about government in general. In the survey, which was run from the 9th of August to the 13th, after the RBA board meeting on August the 6th, showed that Liberal National Party voters were more likely than other people to have a stronger belief that government spending was increasing inflation. JWS researcher Tom Cameron says all governments need to be mindful that there is real scepticism in the community about claims that official policy and budget incentives are helping to lower inflation pressures, which is absolutely spot on. So standing back, three quick points. Expect higher rates for longer. The RBA has really underscored that once again. Secondly, there is the risk that rates will have to go higher if inflation remains as sticky. And thirdly, of course, there's a broader canvas here with regard to some of the international issues and geopolitical issues, which could wreck the trajectory of inflation in any case. But certainly now the gap between Australia and New Zealand is quite clear. And I do believe that Australia should have lifted rates higher quicker rather than actually muddle around in the middle of the road, as it were, and not getting the results that we need to see. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.